Well, good Sunday morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. The United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia and anywhere one might find a lodge in the world is comprised of volunteer students of theosophy, folks who are devoted to studying the philosophy and keeping the philosophy to the fore in front of the public. The principles, the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy, and the exemplification in practice of those principles in an effort to come to a fuller realization of universal brotherhood. This is the work of the Lodge. The Lodge is not an organization. We don't have officers and bylaws, et cetera, et cetera. It's simply an association of students with a similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. And the teaching is the philosophy of theosophy as presented by H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge in the modern day as presented in the Theosophical movement. The Lodge regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and welcomes folks who are in accord with its declared purposes, who desire to fit themselves to be the better able to help and teach others. If you care to pursue how to fit yourself to be the better able to help and teach others, please see someone at the book table, and we'll certainly provide opportunities. Now, the Lodge, as we said, is a voluntary association. All of the works of the Lodge and the presentations that we hold, which are done on Wednesday evening and Sunday morning. The Wednesday evening, actually, the Lodge opens at 5:15, and from 5:15 to 7:15 is a public library, a lending library, or rather a reference library, not a lending library, with all straight-line theosophical teachings, pamphlets, books, magazines. That's open from 5:15 to 7:15. And then from 7:30 on Wednesday evening until 8:30, we have a class each week in the Ocean of Theosophy, which is a Reader's Digest version of the full philosophy. All the presentations here are essentially a presentation of ideas for some 15 or 20 minutes of the hour, and then the rest of the hour is spent in talk and discussion. Everyone is invited to participate. On a Sunday morning from 11 to 12, we have talks and discussions in a rather more formal setting, such as this morning. The doors open at 10:30 on a Sunday. During the month of December, we have this umbrella topic that each Sunday will address. The umbrella topic for the month is cycles and cyclic law. Cycles and cyclic law. Next Sunday, the topic for discussion will be the meaning and symbols of Christmas. The meaning and symbols of Christmas. This lodge is kept open entirely on the basis of voluntary efforts, contributions of time, of service, and of money. No contributions are too small, and no contributions are too large. Any contributions that you wish are certainly gratefully received, and if you'd like to find out how to make those contributions, please see the student at the book table. Now, today's topic is the Gnostic Christos. The Gnostic Christos. An interesting topic with interesting ideas and different words that typically are not found in everyday English. And so we're going to break this topic up between the two panelists. On the one hand, the one panelist will address what is Gnosticism? What is a Gnostic? And then that will be followed by a talk on Gnosticism and the Christos idea of Gnosticism. What is the Gnostic teaching of Jesus Christ? That will, of course, be followed by questions and answers for the rest of the hour. So, gnosis, this word gnosis, this group, Gnostics, actually predate Christianity. They were an esoteric group who sought to, well, let's define them in terms of what we do know. What is theosophy? Very often, the answer to that question is kind of, well, let's pull the word apart, and this is what it is. Theos and Sophi, so it's the wisdom of God or divine ideas. That's the word, but what is theosophy? Well, theosophy is, that's a word, it's kind of a label that we use today, for the ancient wisdom religion. It's as simple as that. And students of theosophy promulgate the ancient wisdom tradition. What is gnosis? Gnosis in the ancient Greek means knowledge. The label gnosis is applied to, surprise, surprise, the ancient wisdom religion. So Gnostics of the pre-Christian era and the post-Christian era, they were students of the ancient wisdom religion whose objective was to present the wisdom religion in its purest light as they could, given the challenges of the time, which were very different then than they are today. So this school, so Gnosis is a school of religious philosophy before and during the first centuries of Christianity. It's also, we could also very definitely call it the Gupta Vidya of the Brahmins, spiritual knowledge. And the Gnostics are the people who formulated and taught the ideas of gnosis. Now, if we look at the history of Gnosticism, and we realize there are the pagan Gnostics and there are the Christian Gnostics, because Gnostics did exist before Christianity. Come along those early centuries of Christianity, and Gnosticism quickly was regarded as a cult. When the church in time gained power in the world and had the self-declared authority to do so, they pretty much stamped out Gnosticism as much as they can. In other words, they pretty much stamped out the ancient wisdom religion to the degree that they could. In the meantime, when these enthusiasts of Christianity came onto the scene, it was the Gnostics who claimed that they had the teachings of the secret doctrines that the Christianity was based on. This is what they had to offer. In time, what would happen is, you know, century by century, persecution would come about of those who knew. Now, why is this? If we look at the church, we'll take a second. If we look at the church versus Gnosticism, one of the criteria to be a Christian at this time was to accept your salvation by having faith in Jesus Christ and devoting yourselves to the oneself to the ideas of the church. It was all based on faith. Gnosis was not a philosophy, is not a philosophy any more than theosophy is, that is based on faith. Rather, it's based on knowledge. Well, knowledge of what? Well, knowledge of principles of law. So if we're talking about salvation, about being saved, the teaching in the Gnosis was by knowing, learning the law and working with the law, this is the basis for growth and salvation, eternal salvation, as opposed to having faith that Jesus Christ is your Lord and Savior. So, now, at the time, in the first century AD, once the Christians came about and this movement started happening, there were two great divisions of Gnosticism. the Alexandrian and the Alexandrian Gnostics and the Ephesian Gnostics. We're going to talk about the Alexandrian Gnostics. Alexandrian Gnosticism is an outgrowth of an Egyptian Christian who went by the name of Basilides. Some of the other names that you'll hear who were Gnostics of the time would be, Valentinus, and we have it all. Valentinus, okay, yes, Valentinus, Basilides, Marcion. You may have heard of Simon Magus and Irenaeus. Basilinus was an emanationist, and this is at a time when the church in the second and third centuries would fight against the Gnostics because the church was not a school of philosophy, but rather was seeking to dominate with authority. And if you would submit to the authority, you are a Christian. Essentially, that's what it boils down to. So during the second and third centuries, this Orthodox Church fought what we've all heard as the heresies. The heresies are the Gnostic doctrines. The word heresy means, you know, to think for oneself. In the fourth century, the church then took these doctrines, the impersonal universal doctrines, and kind of materialized them and carnalized them and dogmatized them into their own rituals. And then in the fifth century after that, made every effort to go through the literature to the extent that they could reach it and wipe out any of the literature that could demonstrate the actual plagiarism that the church did of the Gnostic teachings. Why? Because it was the church's effort rather than to demonstrate the commonality and the common source of all religions. It was the church's effort to say this is the one and only religion, and in order to do that, it had to eliminate any references to other religions. So, in a nutshell, just to give a comparison and a contrast, we'll draw, you know, on the one hand, there's the Orthodox Church, and on the other hand, there is the Gnosis, the philosophical Gnostics. Now, along those lines, the person of St. Peter, not really the individual who lived there, but when you hear something referring to St. Peter, typically that's going to have to do with the Orthodox Church. On the other hand, when one hears something of St. Paul, that's typically going to have something to do with the Gnostic doctrines when we're reading Theosophy. HPB says that St. Paul was very definitely an initiate of the ancient wisdom schools. On the other hand, the church taught of a personal God. Gnostics taught of an absolute divine principle in nature. The Gnostics taught of salvation through Jesus Christ by believing in Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, whereas the Gnostic movement taught about the Christos principle, which will be addressed by the following speaker. There were the church fathers of the Orthodox who eventually, it was essentially a marriage of the church and state of Rome that crushed the Gnostics, and then there were the Gnostic fathers. So we'll just finish up with what we would say is the Christian attitude toward Gnosticism after the second and third centuries. Tertullian, a father of the Orthodox Church, in the early sentences, wrote in a letter to a compadre, "Schoolmasters and professors of literature are in affinity with manifest idolatry and sin." That's just one historical evidence that they're trying to crush out learning. And then there's Eusebius, those intellectuals who continued, who said that there were intellectuals who would continue their studies after changing over to Christianity. And if they continued their studies, he said that, they were accused of abandoning the rule of faith in favor of the subtle precepts of logic. and were declared to be corrupting the Gospels with their reason. So these are comparison and contrast of what it was, and it seems in certain ways that the more things change, the more things stay the same. So the next speaker will give a talk on what the nature of Jesus Christ is through the eyes of a Gnostic.
So to review, in a sense, if you were a Christian living in the second century AD, you had two choices before you, because Christianity was divided at that time into, as was said, those who believed in a personal God and a personal Christ, whom they worshiped in faith, and those who would only acknowledge an absolute deific principle and its presence in humanity, which could be confirmed through self-knowledge. Now, to add to that, all that required of the former was that an acceptation of the doctrines and a belief, a faith. However, the latter was more difficult because the teachers didn't publicly express all their ideas, and one had to make some effort to try to understanding. It was not an easy. One could not be lazy or in applying their mind, but had to have a strong curiosity to understand these ideas. But there was one thing they were clear on and publicly spoke of, and this was this idea of the deific principle or the Christ principle. So you had that presented to you. So the former believed in an anthropomorphic God, a God outside the human being and the universe who created the world out of nothing. And although the Gnostics did not publicly go into the full metaphysics of their teachings, they did teach that deity was an omnipresent and changeless principle, which was the first cause. And from that one absolute and unmanifested first cause proceed the entire manifested universe. The presence of the immortal omnipresent principle in the human being made all of human beings a God in their spiritual essence. And that was the main message to the people. For those that were really interested, they could go into the metaphysics if they were interested. But the idea was that the deific God is everywhere in everything and within all human beings, making them God-like in their potential. So if you chose the former, you became a member of the organized Christian church with its hierarchy of spiritual authorities and rulers who guided you in how to be a true believer in Christ, your Savior. If you chose to affiliate yourself with Christian Gnosticism, a movement within Christianity, you had your own teachers, and they used this word Christos, or Christ, to symbolize the immortal deific principle and its presence in you, as well as every other human being. So if we go to what we have of one of the essential Gnostic texts of the time, the Pista Sophia, it states there, "Know ye not that ye are gods and lords?" Now you would not find that taught in the Orthodox Church at the time. And one of the main teachers you would have come across was Valentinus. And he said, "From the beginning have ye been immortal and children of light." So the first take-home message for you, if you were a Christian living at that time and you heard of Gnosticism, was that Christ is not a being or an entity. Christ comes from a Greek word meaning Christos, which is a symbolic term and name for this impersonal and universal divine principle of spirit present in everything in the universe and within every human soul. Now, we next come to the idea, well, we have these terms Christ, and there was certain recognition of this person having lived, or the tradition of the person having lived, of Jesus. And so the Gnostics had a certain teaching on the Christ condition. And basically for them, the Christ condition was the symbol of the union between the human being and their divine Christos principle, because it's obviously in everything and everyone, but not everyone is aware of it. But through a path of knowledge, there could be a human union in one's heart and mind and soul with this divine principle. And Paul, one of the sources of Gnostic doctrine, said that the purpose was that you may find Christos in your inner man through knowledge. So Christ then is the individual, the great adept of whatever religion, who succeeded through personal effort to live the life and to attain spiritual illumination. They have blended the Son with the Father, the personality with their individual divine spirit, and God within. So that condition, that Christ condition, is the spiritual birthright and possibility of every human being endowed with spirit and soul. So what role did Jesus play? Well, according to theosophy, the man Jeshu, or Jesus, was an adept by virtue of his inner inherent purity. Jesus of Nazareth, or as known in the Kabbalah, Joshua ben Dira, was a rabbi, was a good and holy man, gentle and excellent, who became the way and showed the way to the Christos condition in his admirers and followers. So the second take-home message you would have as a Christian in that time, if you heard about the Gnostics and were considering it, was that the Gnostics maintained that this person, Jesus, you had heard about, was a man overshadowed by the Christos, the inspiring presence, and was a prophet sent for the salvation of nations to recall them to the path of righteousness. And he had a definite message for you that you could find within yourself the knowledge that would bring you to that condition. And there was a name. There had been a name for centuries and ages, even before Christianity, for such an individual who strove to reach that Christos awareness. And they were called Christos, or Christians, basically, which means a good man, a good human being. So the Christos was the devotee striving and struggling to reach the ultimate goal through that path, which was Christos, spiritual enlightenment and truth. So the Christos existed ages before Christianity and was applied to devotee of whatever race or creed. So the third take-home message you might hear from one of these teachers who spoke publicly, that not only are there these Christ or Jesus was such a being, but you within yourself can accomplish that union and reach that condition if you follow the path laid out. So as we've heard, history tells us and demonstrates that the teachings of the Orthodox Church eventually prevailed, and as we know, have continued to hold sway over the hearts and minds of the majority of Christians. However, the Gnosis or knowledge of the Gnostics is universal and timeless. It was an echo of the primordial wisdom and is the birthright and heirloom of the whole of humanity, meaning that humanity in its spiritual nature, every human being, is impressed with certain fundamental spiritual truths. And it is their birthright as a human being coming into that condition to have the capacity through mind and through self-awareness to regain and be able to practically use that knowledge. Now, there are still Gnostics and Gnostic churches and affiliations that go by that name, today. People who identify with the Gnostic ideas, and you can go online and check out all the different groups, and some are more quote orthodox and some are more unaffiliated and less organized, but they all trace back to those teachings of the Gnostics 2,000 years ago. And yet, in a poll just taken 2 years ago, Americans were asked if they considered themselves to be religious. And 20% of Americans, of all faiths, a cross-section of all Americans, identified themselves as being spiritual, but not religious, meaning that they didn't feel it was necessary to be connected with an organized religion to further their spiritual growth. Many of these who responded to the poll identified themselves as Christians and still remain connected with the church, even though they believed it was not the only way or completely necessary. So even after almost 2,000 years, the spirit of truth of Gnosticism lives on in them and is very much alive today. They believe, these people in the poll, when asked what it meant to be spiritual, they believe in a higher power in each that connects all. They feel connected to the world, to this higher power and a higher purpose. And this awareness of this spiritual connection inspires them to be good people. You might say that is a modern, contemporary, simplified version of what it means to can have within oneself that awareness of the Gnostic spirit. Now, perhaps you have some questions and comments on this whole idea. And remember, this is sort of an introduction, laying the groundwork for next week, where we will look into the meaning and symbols of Christmas in terms of this whole idea of cycles and how it affects humanity and nature.
Yes?
It sounds like this is theosophy. So why is it not called theosophy? Or can we, as theosophists, call ourselves Gnostics?
Well, we wouldn't be wrong in calling ourselves Gnostics. They are our brothers in thought, so to speak. But actually, back in Alexandria, those who we refer to as the Neoplatonists, they referred to themselves as theosophists. And one interesting point there is there was an issue between the Neoplatonists, the theosophists of the time, and the Gnostics. And that issue was that come this new enthusiastic movement of Christianity, the Neoplatonists saw Gnostics kind of either Christianizing their Gnostic symbolism by defining Christianity in terms of the symbolism, or maybe they were kind of Gnosticizing the Christian doctrines, so they saw kind of a blend, and they saw it as dangerous, and it was a point of contention that they had with the Gnostics. That being said, if you look at the pure teachings of the Gnostics, HPB is pretty clear about that. They were theosophists. That was the ancient wisdom religion.
Well, the other aspect is that the meaning of Christ for this movement of Gnosticism and Christianity was the same as the meaning of Buddha to the Mahayana Buddhists, and the same as Krishna to the Vedantin Hindus. And when the Kabbalists of the Hebrew faith spoke to the Adam Kadmon, the heavenly man, they were referring to the same idea. So a theosophist could call themselves a Buddhist, a Vedantic Hindu, a Kabbalist, a Gnostic. The point is, as we say in the Declaration, The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, but belongs to each and all. In other words, there are certain truths in all these religious systems which unite them. And as theosophists, we try to study and identify with those fundamental truths which not only come from one source, but unite all peoples in terms of the foundation of their spiritual growth and their ethical development. So that's one thing to keep in mind.
Yes.
So are we saying, in a way, that mankind created this outside God? Well, are we?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Isn't it interesting how we often hear the saying, you know, that God created man in his own image? Well, what is that image? Really, the image that man has of himself when he looks in the mirror, which is a fleeting here today and gone tomorrow image, is the image he creates for himself of his God, if he's of that train of thought. So it is man who creates this being God and then gives it a name and tells everybody else what it looks like, what color eyes it has, what language it speaks, what books it expects you to read, and hence we have the divisions and the separateness of nations based on false ideas, really not of what God is, but false ideas of what man is. When he looks in the pond and sees the reflection of his physical body and identifies with that, it's done so in ignorance of his own spiritual nature.
We could look at it as though the human mind creates the God, but another way is to realize through our study of all these ancient traditions that the God idea has changed through the ages. That at one time, many and were convinced, different portions, that there was not one God, an anthropomorphic figure. They either believed in tribal gods or hierarchies of gods and spiritual beings who guided their lives, or they believe in this absolute divine essence which could not be spoken, could only be symbolized as it was too sacred, or they believed that God was everywhere in nature or in a stone or in a blade of grass. So there was a changing God idea. So if the God idea changes, it does ask one to, it does prompt one to question, well, maybe man didn't create God, whatever that reality is there, but our understanding of it has changed in proportion to our intellectual and our spiritual growth. So as we change spiritually, the old ideas of what God is no longer seem to attract us. And as we said, these people who had taken this poll did not even call it God. They called it a higher power. It's all the words they could come up, a higher spiritual power that connected them all, connected the world, connected them to this supreme power. And when we think about it, that's what the word religion ultimately means. It's funny they say they think of themselves as spiritual but not religious, but because that's because they've been taught that religion is a certain thing. But the word religious, religion in its origin, in the meaning of the word religare, means to bring together, to tie together everything into one inseparable whole, which is the basis of that spiritual idea.
So this division had existed at least since about
500 BCE with the split between Plato and his student Aristotle. There's two camps. And it's kind of ironic in a way that Theosophists were based in Alexandria because it was named after Alexander the Great, who was the student of Aristotle. So this division, of course, had maybe been around long before that, but we're aware of the division between the teachings of Plato, and who was an initiate, and Aristotle, who wanted to create his own thing and be famous for it, and materialize the teachings in a way. And its flowering came forth with the consolidation in Rome of Christianity becoming the state religion. And of course, they had to try to sweep aside all the... It happens throughout history where a new regime comes in. It's happening right now as we speak in different countries where they're trying to like just suppress the ideas of the old regime and then elevate the new ideas. So we just thought that's interesting.
Well, certainly Aristotle was a student, interestingly, of Plato, and yet wrote in such a way that was the opposite of what Plato's teachings were. Alexandria, having been founded by Alexander the Great, was founded not in honor of his teacher, but in honor of his mother. And his mother, it is said, was a high initiate of the ancient mystery schools, which were very definitely on the wane at the time. So the knowledge was still there, but the ancient wisdom was being corrupted in the mystery schools because people, the wealthy, the politically strong, were buying their way into these initiations. So there fell the corruption. So it would seem that the cycle that we have heard so often of, that the downward cycle into the Dark Ages, actually started with the corruption of the mystery schools in the few centuries before. And then Aristotelian philosophy just came to the flower, how probably not by the promulgation of it, but just out of ignorance, by looking at things, anything I can touch, see, feel, or that's the reality, as opposed to the Platonic approach to the reality is the principle behind which or from which this material reality is suspended. The true reality is the divine. Yes.
Well, what we've heard so far sounds like common sense. And we recall that in our youth, discussing these ideas, there was one person who said, "Well, I know." What does he mean? "Well, I know." Meaning that there is a common sense. Is this what you're referring to?
We think when one hears it, these teachings, it makes sense because we know. What does that mean? It means that human beings, all human beings, regardless of how they use the principle, are endowed with self-conscious awareness. Now, when we say we are self-consciously aware, what are we aware of? Well, we are aware of an idea of ourself, but usually we make that very narrow. I am this, we identify with it. I am this body, I am this personality, I have these features, I have this family. And so we are self-consciously aware with this personal idea of ourselves. And we are also self-consciously aware that there is a difference or a separation between ourselves as that personality and nature. We would not say we are a tree. We would not say we are an animal. We would not say we are an insect. We know we are a human being, and that's different. And we're different, we're unique as persons from other human beings. So we have that self-conscious awareness, and we know it. But we can also take that quality of egoism or self-conscious awareness and turn it, as we would say, inward, meaning away from the perceptions of the senses, of our ideas that come from our senses, and just look at ourselves as self-conscious, aware beings, of just saying, I know, I am, I think. And we become immediately aware that we've always been that. Although all these outward things have changed, we are self-consciously know that we are an unchanging being, regardless of the physical changes of the body. We're spiritual in that sense. I know that. I know I am a self-conscious aware. And also, in this talking with others, I become aware that they also are aware of that. And what they identify with is the same thing that I identify. So I know there is something in me that is the same in them. It doesn't change, always there. And there's that connection. So I'm not so separate. I'm not separate at all, not different at all on the spiritual level as I seem to be on the outer level. I know that. So when I hear these teachings of the gnosis, it makes common sense if I have that inner awareness. And the fact is, there have always been the mystically inclined of humanity, those who take this self-conscious awareness and not just direct it to the outer world in order to live and survive on this plane, but also know how to and have directed it within and feel that intuitive knowing and awareness that doesn't depend on the senses or people telling us what to believe or reading at the books. It can be pointed out to us, but it's self-evident through our own inner experience. And that's what the Gnostics mean by knowledge, knowledge that you can know within yourself, spiritual knowledge.
Yes?
There's an expression that attributed to Jesus, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Now, that doesn't sound like a Gnostic saying, But it may have been patterned on one about the way, the truth, and the life, and the Father, of course, in heaven is our higher self.
It, in fact, is a Gnostic saying. It's how it's interpreted or was misinterpreted. So when, as Paul says, when Jesus speaks of himself as being the way, he means that he has become the way. He has become the Christos principle through that effort. And no one comes to that Christos or merges the Son with the Father, the personal with the permanent, lives in the eternal, except through following the way or the path that he shows. Follow the path I show or the way I show. It is Gnostic if you view that from the perspective. If you view it from the perspective that Christ was an individual, unique, the only Savior, the true Savior, and the one who you had to have faith in to reach and get into heaven, then you would see that as you had to accept or believe in Jesus the Christ in order to gain heaven. But it has a completely different application when studied from the point of view of the Gnostics. And that's the point. At that time, if you heard of this individual and you're curious about it, you had to make the choice. Self-induced, self-devised effort to study and really understand within, or just accept, believe, do what you're told, and be guaranteed or insured or with eternal salvation. That was the choice that one had. And both led to a sort of purity, inner purity. Certainly those who followed the teachings of Jesus as they had them in the Bible and lived according to those virtues, they experienced a certain type of inner growth and spiritual development and ethical development, which was very real and sustaining to them. But it also led to certain, it could lead to certain narrowness of thought, which didn't allow that individual to see that possibility of expression in any other form. And so even with Christianity, as time went on, we had the breaking into many different sects and wars between the different sects of Christianity, each believing that their interpretation was the only true one. So the religion, the history of religion, not just with Christianity, but with many religions, has, because of the way we interpret it or understand it, has been more divisive rather than bringing people together.
And isn't it interesting that that line, that passage, you know, no one gets to the Father except through me, could that have been Gnostic? And the answer is that it was Gnostic. And given that Basilides was the Egyptian Gnostic who had great influence, that idea of getting to the Father through Christ actually is a template that's taken from getting to Osiris through Horus. It's in the teachings in the ancient Egyptian traditions. Yes.
Well, once we began to listen to these ideas, try to put it into practice, there's a declaration of war that takes place within us. How is that possible? It seems we run into a lot of difficulties by even trying to understand these teachings and put them into practice. We've heard of the term war in heaven. Language, if understood, would help us. What does that mean?
Before we approach that from the Gnostic point of view, we might go back to a tradition we're maybe more familiar for those that have been coming to classes, especially in the summer, on the Bhagavad Gita. And we know at the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita takes place on a battlefield, and it's a war between two branches of the same family, and it's allegorical for the human condition. That there are higher spiritual powers, universal impressions in us, as well as the lower sensual, selfish, physical, and attachments. And as Arjuna, we sense them both. And there's a battle as to which will take preference in us. And the individual has to struggle to achieve union with Krishna, or have that power, that Krishna power within them manifest and help them in the battle. The same idea is brought out in Gnosticism, but in a more metaphysical way, and it's represented as these different degrees of intelligent forces, not only in nature, but also in the human being. And this is the same idea as in the Gita, that in the human being, a copy of nature, we have in us these spiritual forces and these lower forces. And they all are within us. And the struggle is, as taught there as well, is to become pure, to make one's union with the higher, but we have to deal with these lower temptations, these forces within us. Now, whatever name they gave them, the ideas were the same as those expressed by the Hindus. In the Kabbalah, they're called the Sephiroth, and the Hindus may call them Devas, and in the Gnostic scheme, they were called eons. But regardless of the term used, the idea was the same. They were talking about the human being reflecting all the powers, higher and lower, within themselves, and having to choose which ones will predominate.
There was a hand.
There was a statement made that of how the Gnostics, felt, they had this choice they had to make. Well, aren't we in the same situation?
Well, it's that's why we talk about the Gnostic.
Son of a gun.
We're not, we're all, it's the human condition, right? And so in any age, there's always that choice. That's what Krishna faced, what Arjuna faced on the battlefield. Whether he was going to respect, follow the line of his teachers and a certain part of his family, or come to grasp and hold on to the spiritual truths which we began to recognize, which were going to win out, where, and it was a battle for him. And so it is for us today. We may be born into a certain religious tradition, or we may be born into a family that is very supportive and helps us find our own ideas. But sooner or later, as individual souls, we face a choice, or through experiences where we decide for ourselves whether those ideas are still valid to us, or if not, we begin to search. And as we pointed to, there are many more people coming out and saying that they're spiritual, not religious. Unfortunately, in our society, an even larger percentage say they're not religious at all. They're not spiritual. They don't have any faith. And that's the really sad situation. They have neither the support of an organized religion or to guide them, or the inner spiritual one, but have lost their faith in anything. And that's something that we need to address as a society. Yes?
Now, that first few sentences in the Declaration, independent devotion. And many of us, especially the young ones, strive and try to find out what is independent devotion, not agreeing with what they hear others say. The idea to know for oneself independently, by study or otherwise. And these are very, very, very potent words we use, and we come back again and again and again to find.
Well, that's the challenge, the independent devotion. Most people aren't aware, but actually in Christian doctrine, there are two means to salvation. And one is salvation by accepting Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. The other one carries over into Christian theology from Judaism, which is to live according to the law. Now, to live according to the law, as we have found as students of theosophy, is not something that somebody can dictate to you. One has to learn the law for oneself and apply it according to his circumstances, his understanding, and nobody can judge it. So it makes sense, even though in Christian theology that is recognized as one. It's not taught, it's not talked about, it's certainly not promulgated, because it would seem they probably lost the means, the methods, and the teachings on how to do it. They haven't lost the ethics, though. They haven't lost the do unto others as you would have them do unto you. There are certain principles that are found in all the religions. But when someone who is brought up in any of the Orthodox religions reaches a certain point and asks, okay, of course, I'm a good person, of course I'll be good, but why? Why do I have to be good? And why, even though I'm good, do bad things happen to me? And all of these whys that aren't answered, that a lot of people really don't care about the answers. Going to church is fine with them, really, and they're good people anyway. But if you're looking for the answers behind the questions, how many Orthodox, anything in any of the religions are going to stand out and say, really, we do have it? Well, there's a saying. You know, the saying is, surround yourself with truth seekers, But when you find yourself surrounded with those who know the truth, run. Once they say that they have found the truth, you know you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. Yes?
So if the problem is, though, if these good people are following a program and somebody else comes along with another program, they're going to follow that, too. They're not going to test, check, and verify. They're already preconditioned to go with the flow. And that's a real problem in society, we think.
So to speak, the comment here is there are so many people who are preconditioned to go with the flow, and the orthodoxy of those churches is still there. They're not doing too much different today than they were centuries ago. But there's a lot more folks, obviously, who are not going with the flow. And the challenge is, you know, it's when people answer the poll questions of, are you religious? No, I'm spiritual. How many of them actually have taken that next step other than to recognize their own spirituality, but to do something about it, to use it or to develop it or to grow from it, to recognize their own divinity and grow within that? That's a great question, because there are certainly a lot of distractions that people literally, so to speak, fall victim to. And that's one of the issues that theosophy takes here is there is a path, there is a way, but don't expect somebody to come and do it for you. However, if you're interested and you're devoted to finding the way, there are those who have pointed out the way.
Just to pick up on one of those points, which I thought deserve repetition. If you are satisfied with the faith you have, and that's all that matters, and it's good enough for you to have faith, to believe, and just go on with your lives, accumulating the pleasures, providing for your family. That's one thing. But if you say, well, my faith isn't enough, my family isn't enough, I need to understand why I feel this way. I need to understand why this is true. I need to understand why I'm being taught these ethics when there's obviously so much injustice in the world, why good people suffer, why bad people get away with it, why people are born into such miserable circumstances and I'm not, or I'm born into miserable circumstances and they're not. If you ask yourself, why should I believe in those things? I need to know, then you're a Gnostic. Regardless of what religion you affiliate with, you have the Gnostic spirit. And whatever is presented to you in whatever tradition, Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism, you'll find yourself attracted to those teachings in there which give you an understanding of why, give you knowledge, as opposed to just asking you to have faith and believe. Jeremy, your hand up.
My previous understanding of Gnosticism was that it was something that developed like relatively simultaneously with Christianity, but you were saying it's pre-Christian. Was those pre-Christian people, did they refer to themselves as Gnostic, or is that a term later attributed to
the Essenes? The Essenes were the pre-Christian Gnostics.
Oh, okay.
And yes.
Essenes, there was a school, in Essenian school, there was a school in Ephesus in Asia Minor, and of course the Alexandrian school in Egypt. So the Gnostic term, being from the Greek, preceded the Christian era for hundreds of years. But the idea of Gnosis was even older. The Christians who identify with this treatment and call themselves Gnostics were Christian Gnostics. And more people knew about that, and that has survived to our, those ideas have survived to our age more than the others. So the general idea of Gnosticism is it's a Christian idea, but it was a movement within Christianity, but it also existed before Christianity. It was just the names were changed, the words were changed, and some of the doctrines were, but the same philosophy was there in all of them. So next week, as we said, keeping with this idea of cycles and, of course, the season of the year, we're going to look at the meaning and symbols of Christmas in the light of theosophy, in the light of the universal wisdom and understanding of the laws of nature. And this Wednesday, we're getting into the desire principle, the middle principle, the balance principle. And one of the key points in there is at some point, a human being such as a Jesus or a Buddha or a Krishna had to make the vow that they were going to save a part of humanity. And through that desire to maintain that vow life after life, they eventually reached that condition, that godlike status. So the desire principle is very important for our spiritual growth. Unfortunately, we sometimes misuse it and it becomes an obstacle to our growth and happiness. So we'll have that idea presented on Wednesday. Our meeting's adjourned.